When U.S. and Israeli bombs fall on Iran, and Iranian bombs then strike American regional bases and even ritzy hotels in Dubai, it sure has the look of war. Did the president have the authority for this war under the Constitution? Defenders of President Trump's power say it'll be worth a little constitutional slippage if things turn out well. So, is a happy ending likely? We discuss these questions and more on today's episode of Independent Conversations. Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. Join me in welcoming to this difficult conversation two of our most adept and well-informed senior fellows, Dr. Ivan Eland and Dr. William Sinevers. Hello, Ivan and Bill. Glad to have you.
Hi, Graham.
Glad to be here.
So let me pose the first question to you, Ivan. Article 1 of the Constitution gives Congress alone the power to declare war. Article 2 names the president commander-in-chief. In the bombing campaign against Iran, it kind of has the look or has had the look of President Trump using Article 2 to bulldoze Article 1, but he says it couldn't be helped because the bombing was necessary under the circumstances. Ivan, has the president properly exercised his Article 2 power as commander-in-chief?
I would say a resounding no. In your leading, you said people in the administration had said, well, even if we have a little constitutional slippage, the results will be worth it.
It was a paraphrase.
Right. No, but I mean, that people actually believe that. But of course, every war we have, there's constitutional slippage. And then now we're down to, and Trump is not the first president to do this, we should say, of just go to war and not tell anybody why and not get any approval from Congress at all, not even an authorization rather than a declaration of war. So we're far away from the Constitution. In the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes are the best record that we have, although imperfect. And he says that they originally had the words make war, which would mean to initiate war. And they still meant that, but somebody said, well, what if, you know, we're out of session a lot, the Congress will be, so what if there's an attack, an imminent attack on the United States, and that's a key phrase there, then we need the president to be able to have self-defense capabilities. Everybody goes, yes, that's right. But if we're going on an offensive war, meaning overseas, we have to have a declaration of war. Now, since the beginning of the 20th century, that has been eroding, and it's significantly eroded to where now presidents claim, well, it's just a courtesy that we get approval, as the two Bushes did in both Gulf Wars. But this is a regional war which has tremendous escalation potential. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in war, and you always have to say that because war is chaos, but this has the potential, at least, to be very escalatory. And also, there was no imminent threat to justify doing anything of this sort without congressional approval.
When you mention imminent threat, now, that language is not in Article 1 or Article 2 of the Constitution. You're quoting something else, are you not?
Well, the general tenor of the what minimal record there is in the Constitutional Convention was they needed, you know, if the country was about to be attacked or attacked, they changed it to declare war. But they still, if you read all the founders, James Wilson, James Madison, they clearly meant the Congress will initiate war unless there's an imminent reason that the president, who is, you know, the commander of the armed forces, thinks, you know, it's a dire situation. And even then, they put him as the commander-in-chief to reaffirm civilian control of the military. They were reacting to the European monarchs taking their countries to war and the costs in blood and treasure falling on their citizens. And they didn't want that to happen in America. They wanted a peaceful, republic.
You know, it's fascinating to me. Bill gave me yesterday an interesting article by our friend Ilya Soman, who points out that Alexander Hamilton, who was, of course, at the time of those founding discussions, probably the foremost exponent of strong executive power. He agreed with Madison on this point, quotes Hamilton here, the legislature have a right to make war. It is the duty of the executive to preserve peace till war is declared. So that makes it very clear that, even though there are a few things on which those two agreed, this was one in which they essentially did agree. President has to keep things cool until Congress says, okay, we're declaring war. Unless presumably, I guess this is implied, there's an attack on the United States. Bill, have I got that right?
I think you do.
Yeah. So that means that we're kind of in a constitutional no man's land here in terms of authorization. The Trump administration has invoked, I think, the 1973 War Powers Act. Is that right? Can either of you comment on that?
It's not really that they invoke it. It applies to their activities. Now, there's multiple schools of thought about the War Powers Resolution, and Ivan, I'm sure, will want to chime in on this also. So the advocates of a strong president say, well, this is unconstitutional. It's inhibiting the president's power, Article 2 power, as commander-in-chief. And it's, entangling him. So another kind of strict constitutionalist who is paying more attention to Congress's power to authorize war says, well, there's sort of an implication in the War Powers Act that the president gets a 60-day blank check to wage aggressive war without congressional authorization, although the defenders of the War Powers Resolution say, well, actually, Congress has the power to stop that at any time. But anyway, of course, they never do that. But the point is, many people who had high hopes for the War Powers Resolution as a way to check the presidency of the Vietnam era have been disappointed because the president's, first of all, they never acknowledge that it's a valid law. And secondly, they just figure out ways to get around it. I think Ivan would concur with that.
Yes, and
in
history. It's worse than that. The Congress often pretends like it's doing something without really doing something. And the War Powers Act is an example of that, because if the preamble were legally binding, it would be fine. They're further limiting the president's power because it says, we're supposed to declare war, but in these other cases, by the preamble, they were limiting the 60 to 90 day period that the president had to get the troops out of there if Congress didn't approve to this defensive type of scenario.
Yeah.
In all offensive wars, the preamble says you will declare war. But the problem is they conveniently put that in the preamble, so it doesn't legally apply. So essentially, the War Powers Act does give the president, in practice, a 60 to 90 day, well, 60 days, unless it's re-upped by Congress, 60 day period to put forces in. And that on the ground, that's tremendous, because once the troops are on the ground, there's very little appetite under any circumstances by both parties to cut funding for the war. Now, that's happened as wars have dragged on in Bosnia and
Vietnam.
Vietnam, where they actually did that, but that's very rare. And so, therefore, the president knows he has at least 60 days to play around the world without anything happening.
And the White House, it was a funny thing where Bill Maher had Senator Adam Schiff from California on, and he read the White House statement that when the president has a right to act when he deems it's in the national security interest of the United States. And he said to Adam Schiff, well, don't you think that's too vague? And I said, yes, much too vague. And Bill Maher said, well, yes, that's what Obama said when was it Obama or Clinton? Anyway, it was that was the what the White House said pertaining to attacking Libya.
Yes, and also
that was Obama.
Yeah, Obama. Obama also played the War Powers Act says they must, you know, this law kicks in if there's imminent hostilities or hostilities, and Obama said, well, we're only using air power to bomb Libya to try to overthrow Gaddafi, and nobody's they don't have an air force that's worth anything, so there's going to be no deaths in the sky, and there's no ground troops. So the act doesn't
This is
even
an
go
early
into...
version of the excursion theory.
This what does
is
that
like
mean?
An aerial excursion.
Right.
But at any rate, they said the law doesn't apply because there's no hostilities. I'm saying you're dropping bombs. You know, any common person would say that's hostilities, right? But they say, well, if there's no potential for U.S. casualties, and of course there are, a plane could crash out of its own mechanical failure or whatever.
A blockade is an act of war.
That's right.
A missile is an act of war.
Yes, but well, the whole thing was preposterous.
A drone attack is an act of war.
Yeah. And in Clinton's case, he went to war in disregard of a congressional vote under the War Powers Act that he shouldn't do it. So there's one way to evade it, and then there's the next way to evade it, but they all feel that it really doesn't apply to them.
It's an actual embarrassment to people who think the Constitution has a role to play in, you know, keeping the state in line. This war powers thing, I mean, the last time the United States declared war, you don't have to declare, you could authorize, but the last time we declared war was against Romania in 1942. And there have obviously been authorizations since that. Truman claimed it was the United Nations. Being in the United Nations does not override the Constitution. Anyway.
So Truman, the root of the problem really started big time with Truman because he did not.
That's right.
That's a major
that was
war.
That was a real war.
Yeah. And he didn't get, he flagrantly didn't get congressional
declaration
of war. And the Congress applauded him for it. And that's been the precedent that really changed things, I think, for the Korean War in 1950.
I agree.
So there's just been a whole series of military actions, some of them reactive, some initiated by U.S. presidents, so that whenever a U.S. president initiates military action, as in the current case, it's obvious the thing to say, at least, is to say, well, all my predecessors did it, so, you know, why am I going to be held to a higher standard? And that's a question.
I don't think past bad behavior justifies future bad behavior. I don't think two wrongs make a right. I also noticed that when the president first talked about this, he said there was an imminent threat. There hasn't been any evidence of that. Now, you can say technically that when the U.S. struck the nuclear facilities in June, that there was still a little hole somehow to get down in there. And these containers of nuclear material are about the size of scuba tanks. And you could say something could happen, but, you know, severe damage was done. The United States, after all, this is a somewhat heretical thing to say, but when Red China got a bomb and it was ruled by Mao Zedong, the United States and the Soviet Union, who both were worried about what Mao might do, did not attack China. Even though Mao, this is much more strenuous than what the Ayatollahs have said, what the mullahs have said in Iran, who seem to have some at least claimed to have a just war theory. Mao believed in using nuclear weapons to advance socialism. He told lots of people that, including Milovan Gilas and others knew about it. The conversations with Stalin, I think, covers this. It was, yet the world lived with that. There was no imminent threat to a U.S. bases, to the nuclear program, just on the verge nuclear program. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ivan.
I think that that's really true. They didn't, they didn't go after Mao. There was some debate about whether to do that, but they didn't do it. And the other issue is a threat to what, right? The founders had intended that this self-defense exception for the presidency was if the United States itself was under attack. Now, of course, right. We have imperial bases all over the place. So, the real problem is they're bringing about the only danger that Iran poses to the United States is attacking its bases, because it doesn't have missiles to get here. It doesn't have a nuclear weapon yet, but they're precipitating the threat that they're saying that they're, right.
So I saw a list, Ivan, fairly early in the conflict of 11 U.S. bases that had been struck.
Right, and that's the primary
usually
threat.
Usually with minimal damage,
that
but that's exactly what
the
you're...
United States, and they're bringing
exactly
it on,
that's exactly what
right?
you're referring to.
So let me just play devil's advocate here for a second, or get a question out on the table. It seems pretty clear from what both of you have said and from what I have read that the Iranian nuclear and or long-term missile threat was not imminent in the usual sense of the term. But maybe somebody could argue that, the reason that they didn't go against Mao is because they already had the darn thing, whereas the Iranians were still going to get themselves closer and closer to having it, and so better to preemptively take out the threat. Ivan, what's the response, your response to that?
Well, as far as nuclear weapons, both the U.S. intelligence community and the International Atomic Energy Agency, who inspects all these facilities around the world, they both said that Iran discontinued its weapons program, nuclear weapons program, in 2003, and they had seen no evidence to show them that they've started up again. Now, they're enriching uranium, and they're enriching uranium at higher levels than they were because Trump, in his first term, discontinued the 2015 nuclear deal, which would have gotten limited Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. So Trump is the one who pulled that. It was a very foolish thing that he did. And he could have also, the negotiations were along that similar lines. And so he interrupted the first nuclear negotiations last June, when he attacked Iran, tried to attack the nuclear program. And then the negotiations were going on again, and he did the same thing. And so as far as missiles, so they're not really close to getting a weapon. They could get it in maybe 6 months, because even if you get enough enriched uranium, and they're at 60%, they first have to get it up to 90%, which is weapons grade. Then you have to make it into metal, which requires a few months to do if they have the technology, because weaponizing it, we'll make it into a warhead, is not all that easy. And then, of course, they have to have a delivery vehicle to the U.S., and they don't. They have a limit right now of 1,200 miles on their missiles, which is not going to get it anywhere close to the United States. So they don't have what's called an intercontinental ballistic missile, which is a fast missile which can go 3,500, 4,000 miles to get to the U.S. So the nuclear thing, there's no imminent threat, and there hasn't been for a long time because there's no evidence that shows that they've restarted their nuclear weapons program. Now they have a nuclear program, and that's what we're talking about here. That is never made, distinction is usually not made in the press. As far as the missile goes, I just mentioned that they have no delivery vehicle to get it here. And so when you talk about the nuclear threat, we should always say to the United States. That's always left off the thing. Maybe the Europeans are marginally threatened by the longer range Iranian missiles. The Israelis certainly are, but the United States is not. So there's really no imminent threat in either the nuclear or missile categories.
So just to elaborate a little bit on what Ivan said, which I think was all correct, perfectly correct. You could bomb Israel with a nuclear bomb, but Israel could bomb you back. Okay, so that's not just an easy thing to set. The second thing is, okay, so 20% enrichment makes sense for energy uses of nuclear weapons. Why are they doing this 60%? Well, Ivan pointed out that the ceiling on this had been taken away, but there's still a question of, well, what are they doing? So here are two possibilities. I'm trying to put on the hat of an objective observer here and not defending them doing this. One might be deterrence. They live in a very dangerous area, and maybe they're afraid of some of the surrounding countries or the U.S. bases. Secondly, they are subject to all kinds of sanctions and prohibitions and whatever. Maybe they want a bargaining chip, as I think Ivan was trying to somewhat explain. Some of these previous Iran-U.S. negotiations were around, changing the enrichment level, and then in return, Iran gets something. Well, then Iran wants some of those things that it might get. So it's not necessarily that they were on the way to a nuclear weapon, which they do have a religious inhibition about. Now, many countries have supposed religious inhibitions in their belief systems about just blowing up millions of people, but they figure out ways to overcome that. That certainly might happen in Iran's case as well. But it's just worth mentioning anyway.
I think there's a third possibility, and that is that they want to be a near nuclear power like Japan. Japan could make a nuclear weapon very quickly, but they don't want to because of their pacifist constitution. I think the same thing is true here, given what you said, Bill, that there are some religious inhibitions to getting a nuclear weapon. So I think they may want to go to 60, which is above the 20% for research level, just so they can, if they need to, or as a deterrent, they could more quickly go to 90%. And so I think that may be a third possibility. And also, when I said that limit, I meant that limit's not off. The limit is still on of the 1,200-mile limit for the missiles, but that's self-imposed by Iran itself. And I think they did that to stay away from what's actually happening now, not threaten the United States to the extent that they, they would be attacked by a superior power, because we have bigger bombs and many more planes than the Israelis do.
I would also mention that Israeli leaders, in particular Netanyahu, have been saying that the Iranians are a month or 2 weeks or something away from having a viable atomic bomb for decades. Do you agree, Ivan?
Yes. And also, I never thought this was about nuclear weapons. I always thought it was about Israel trying to weaken its major foe regionally. And they wanted to get the U.S. to do it because, as I just mentioned, the U.S. has bigger bombs and a much more capability. So they've been wanting to drag, and Netanyahu even said this the other day, that he's been wanting to do this for 40 years, and he finally dragged a U.S. president into doing it with him.
By the way, in the opinion polling, the only thing that gets a positive result for the war, it's generally not liked in the United States, is Would you favor attacking Iran in order to stop them from having an imminent nuclear weapon? When you ask that, the public says, oh, yeah, let's get them.
But to summarize what you both have been saying, the claim of imminence on that score is just so implausible. But useful.
Yes, it's useful. I don't want to, I think Ivan and I would both say, it's not crazy to say that Iran could create a nuclear weapon. And it's not crazy, you know, after some time. And it's not crazy to say that they couldn't create an intercontinental ballistic missile. They could, but whether it's in, whether it's being done in the near term and whether we could detect these things if they got along farther along, I think that's what's being left out also.
Yeah, we could. You know, you're saying we could detect them.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Also, but, you know, going back to what Bill said about Israel, Israel already has a large number of warheads. They're the only nuclear power in the Middle East. So,
right.
You know, if they, they think that they have enough
they have a deterrent.
Uranium at 90% enrichment to get about 6 bombs right now. Now, they could expand that, but Israel has hundreds of bombs, and the U.S. has thousands of bombs. I mean, if they ever wanted to nuke the U.S. with a missile fired from Iran, you can spot where that comes from, and guess what happens? We incinerate their country, or we incinerate a lot of it, and then we say, we're going to incinerate the rest of it if you don't stop that, right? So it's a little bit much to think that they wouldn't be deterred by both Israel and the United States with those types of arsenals already in being.
Leaving aside the nuclear missile issue, it's true that Iranian missiles can reach U.S. bases around the Gulf and the Middle East, and they kind of reach luxury hotels and banks in Dubai and so forth. But what I want to know is, why does the United States have so many bases in the Middle East and around the Persian Gulf? What's that about?
Well, I think, so, you know, some people will say, oh, it's to help Israel. But I think more important, much more important, is the Straits of Hormuz and the flow of oil and the effect. It's not, and by the way, it's not that the United States gets physical drops of oil that are going through the Straits of Hormuz. Not particularly a ton of it goes to Asia. But the economy of the world is wrapped up in this energy. And I think that's the main reason they're there. And some of it's, you know, there's all kind of strange strategic doctrines that past presidents have had about the Middle East, and we're somewhat heir to those, and, you know, so some of it's
residual.
I think
it can affect the oil price. It can't really, in the long term, choke off oil. I mean, this is a very drastic thing that the Iranians are doing, because they have avoided this even when they were in their 8-year war with Iraq.
Because they get money from oil going through the Straits of Hormuz.
Right, right.
So the old thing that applies to Saddam Hussein or anybody who has oil is, so some American commentator will say, oh, they could cut us off from their oil. Okay, well, they could, but then they're just shooting themselves in the foot. And same with the Saudis or anybody else that has a lot of oil. You can either sit on it and get no revenue, or you can sell it, and, you know, you can sell it even irregularly. So there are these ghost fleets and, you know, piratical smuggle type ways of getting stuff out. But if it's coming from Kuwait, Iran, Iraq, or a lot of the production in Saudi Arabia, you got to go through that Strait of Hormuz.
Of course, if you do take a drastic action like that and it reduces the supply of oil, the price goes up, and that the price mechanism works. Other producers start producing more. United States,
that's
Russia
right.
could be throwing more into the market,
right.
et cetera. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Back to Washington, D.C., Congress presumably could try and choke this thing off if they were opposed to it. Seems like recently there was an attempt to have a war powers vote on this, but I think it didn't go anywhere, if I'm not mistaken. What's the story on that?
Well, I think the Republicans are support for the time being are supporting Trump, even though this war is one of the most unpopular wars to start off with. Which is one reason why you want to get a congressional resolution that we were talking about earlier. It, regardless of what the Constitution says or the War Powers Act says, it's really smart when you're doing a major military action to get Congress to buy in on it because they represent the people. And also, if things go wrong, then it's a shared problem. And LBJ, for all his faults, and he had been the majority leader of the Senate, and he knew that he needed to get some sort of authorization for escalation in Vietnam, because if things went bad, and they did, and it took a long time for the public opinion till 69, it took like 4 years before the war became unpopular. We already have an unpopular war at 41% approval rate. So Trump is taking a big risk if this war goes on longer, as the casualties mount, as the costs come in, and people were going, yeah, why? I didn't understand why we were doing that anyway, and nobody asked us, so the Congress is more likely to be dissatisfied later because he didn't get some sort of approval. And I think the two Bushes knew that in the Iraq War, which is why they said, well, as a courtesy, we have the authority to do it, but as a courtesy to the Congress, we'll let them vote on this.
Let's
not be too friendly to what Lyndon Johnson did, because the Gulf of Tonkin incident was probably bogus.
Well, yes, yes. I'm not endorsing that. I'm just saying that he realized smartly that he wanted to use that to get approval because he knew that he was very pessimistic when he got into the war to begin with, that was going to be winning. So I think he was hedging his bets. So he brought everybody in with him to be part of the, you know, pity party later. So
are you saying that President Trump should have wanted to get a congressional war powers authorization vote, because that way there's shared blame? But lacking
yes, he's out there. See, the Congress never wants to vote on this because they want to come in later and criticize if things go wrong. But then they want to bask in the glory if things go right. But they want the executive to take all the risk involved in that. And so it really, I would think it should be the opposite way, that the president should be going, hey, we want to vote on this. And that's what George W. Bush did. He held it right before the election, the vote, so because he knew that the Democratic congressmen, a lot of them didn't want to vote against a war before the election. And so he was very cagey in doing that. But he was smart in doing that as well.
So, but the thing is the War Powers Act itself constitutionally valid? I mean, from what you all said a few minutes ago, in the guise of limiting presidential war-making power, it seems actually to have empowered presidents by giving them a 60-day get-out-of-jail-free card.
I think instead of spending a lot of time on this, you could just ask Ivan and me, if we were on the Supreme Court and a case came before us, what would we say? And I would vote, it's unconstitutional, because you have to follow what the Constitution says, which is that absent repelling an attack or facing an imminent threat, direct physical threat to the United States, Congress has to authorize the war. And the War Powers Act obscures and obfuscates and lowers that requirement.
It basically makes the president able to declare a war for a 60-day period.
Right. Right. That's what it does.
So yes. Ivan would vote to say it's unconstitutional too.
Yes, but I think both of us would say it's a different reason we think it's unconstitutional than all the people
That's
of the
right.
executive a unitary theory of the executive
right.
and you know, right. proponents of the executive branch, we think it gives the president too much authority, and they think it constrains the president too much.
Right.
Exactly right.
That's pretty wild. Okay.
But also, as long as it's there, we certainly can't blame people in Congress who might have a sincere belief in its efficacy to want to try to use it. So
right.
we understand
That's
that.
Right. Yes.
Okay, let's look back over to Iran then. So the U.S. and Israel began this bombing campaign. There's retaliation. There's a lot of damage on the ground. Many people have said, well, this is a regime change effort. Let's talk about possible likely outcomes in Iran. Is it possible that this military initiative by the U.S. and Israel could trigger a collapse of the Islamic regime in Tehran and usher in an era of democracy and freedom?
I think it's possible, but unlikely. So the reason I would say it's possible is if you look at falls of government, it could be the fall of the Saigon government at the end of the Vietnam War. It could be the fall of the Soviet Union. It could be any number of things. It's unpredictable. In retrospect, political science can say, historians can say, oh, yeah, gee, obvious, and everybody could see it coming. But you know what? They couldn't see it coming. And it can happen really fast because it's so famous political theorists, particularly David Hume, said, government rests more than it does on guns, even on the acquiescence of the population. And the population will go, they don't have to love it, they don't have to like it, but they have to say, I'm going along for whatever reason with this. And at some point, they can get fed up. They can say, this is enough. This is not something I want to live with anymore. And they just, you know, the police stop enforcing the law, the army stops fighting, the public stops obeying the authorities, and it falls. And it can be at the end of a long war. I mean, look at the Russian Revolution of 1917. You know, they were fighting a long war with Germany, and they were losing all over the place, and they were demoralized, and the government, you know, in February, it just started collapsing. And it can happen. Now, is it likely? I don't think so, because, and Ivan, I know we'll have important input on this, but there's several reasons. First of all, it's a revolutionary regime that's still fairly young. So when you talk about the Soviet Union collapsing in the 1980s, hey, they were a gerontocracy of kind of demoralized. They didn't have, so one of the things that Crane Britton, who's written a book called The Anatomy of Revolution, he says, the ruling classes have to have the will to stay in power. Okay, and the communists in Russia didn't really have that anymore. And they didn't really believe their own theory anymore. The problem is that there is a huge number of, let's say the majority of the population doesn't agree with the mullah's regime. I think that's probably true. But the mullah's regime still has a fighting spirit. They believe that they are right. They believe in 12er Shiism. They believe in the rule of the jurist. They believe in the righteousness of this. They believe that Israel is the small Satan and the United States is the great Satan. And that is a glue that holds them together with having all this army. So that is enough, even if they're 20 to 30% of the population, but they're still well organized. That's enough to stick on, in my view. Now, there are some problems with the legitimacy of the new great leader who was just elected, because one of the criticisms that the Mullah's revolution had of the Shah was that his system was based on hereditary principles. And so it meant you got mediocre people who were bad leaders or who were corrupt or who were lazy or whatever.
So how ironic it is that they're appointing the,
that's
the
right.
son
so
of
So this
the...
is hereditary. It's like the Kim Il-sung, the Kim dynasty. And communists are also supposed to not have... communists is, you know, in theory, it's supposed to be meritocratic. But this family and maybe... even future generations, it looks like, are going to rule in North Korea. Well, they're having that in Iran. Also, they're supposed to be a kind of philosopher ruler under the mullah's system, under this rule of the jurist. This is supposed to be a selected grand ayatollah. In other words, they are at high-level PhD professor-type level knowledge of jurisprudence and Muslims, 12 or Shia theology. This kid who's just been put in there is at like, he just got a BA, okay? He just got a Bachelor of Arts. He is not a distinguished scholar the way the original ruler Khomeini was. And so not all 12 or Shiites, not all Shiites accept this rule of the jurist idea, but it's certainly very influential in Iran. And so he doesn't meet the criteria. This could hurt their, remember I said they had this ideological glue that's holding them together. This problem could undermine them.
That's pretty fascinating, Bill, because that implies that there are internal reasons that the regime could weaken itself by appointing him.
I'll give you a thing that helps him, though. In the Shia tradition, martyrdom is hugely important because Shia, the meaning of the word Shia is followers of Ali. So Ali was a member of Prophet Muhammad's family, and he was killed in Iraq by another set of Muslims. And so the origins of Shia are in martyrdom, and they have huge value to martyrdom in the Shia tradition. So this guy is the son of a martyr, and that will help his legitimacy. But the foundational principles of non-hereditary rule and of rule of a distinguished jurist don't apply to him.
I just had to add to that. That's a... What you just heard is a very complex analysis, and I assure you that the administration didn't go through any of that before it did this. So, but I will say that in addition to the legitimacy problem that the new leader has, the one positive thing is he's very closely associated with the Revolutionary Guard group, which runs the country basically, and the Basij, which is the internal secret police, and he doesn't have the religious credentials, but he has the guns. And it's true that the people have to acquiesce to any regime, but one of the factors is how many guns do you have, and how, or potential guns, and how many guns does the 20% or the other 20% who doesn't support the regime, or who does support the regime, how many guns do they have? And so they pretty much have all the guns. Now, the other issue is Robert Pape, who's a distinguished scholar at the University of Chicago, wrote this book, two decades ago, or I'm not sure exactly when he wrote it, but Bombing to Win. He went through every attempt at regime change, every attempt, historical, and just bombing countries has a track record of zero regime change, zero. Now, that doesn't mean this couldn't be the first one, of course, but this is how effective this is, because there's all sorts of internal factors, as Bill just mentioned. So it's going to be very interesting to see what Trump does if the regime doesn't go away, because he sort of made the mistake of saying, well, this is a regime change thing, and I'm sure his critics are going to hold him to that.
I think if I remember correctly, my history that during World War II, the Allies thought that their massive bombing campaign, which was pretty destructive. And one thing about this bombing campaign, which is certainly some collateral damage, but compared to the collateral damage in World War II, it's kind of modest, okay? So that's progress in war fighting. But anyway, the U.S. and Britain thought that they were going to destroy the morale of the German population by all these bombs. Didn't happen. It actually consolidated their feeling they had to defend the homeland and that Hitler was their leader and that they, you know, they were being mistreated by these bombs. And it I believe, solidified support for the regime.
Yes, the industrial production of Germany actually went up during the bombing. And also, well, more generally, what we're talking about here is a rally, what's called a rally around the flag effect. Think about our own country. We never think about, you know, the empathizing with the other country, but that doesn't mean you agree with a fundamentalist Islam regime, which oppresses its people. But in warfare, Napoleon said, you have to empathize with the other person to put yourself in their shoes as to what the enemy is going to do, because the enemy always has a vote, right? It's not some woke idea. You have to, what are they going to do? And of course, the Iranians have a long history of wily behavior and fighting asymmetrically. And they have a lot of opposition to their regime. And that's what Trump thought he would take advantage of here, to just bomb and get the regime out of the way. But the problem is the rally around the flag effect, and that what happened in 9/11, Bush hit the high, George W. Bush hit the high of polling during any period, 90%. Even all but the most left Democrats said, okay, you know, we've been attacked and we're not used to being attacked in the United States. And so we're supporting this guy. We don't really like him, but he's our president. And that can be happening in any country, including Iran. And some of the people that really oppose the regime, I'm not sure that this is helping them. And in fact, it's probably fortifying the regime in certain respects.
I would also say something about these, it's kind of complicated because there's so many undercurrents and levels and splits and whatever, but the opposition in Iran has not been a fighting like guerrilla warfare or something like that. It's been street protests mostly. And there's also been voting for reform candidates. Reform candidates in Iran have not, they never really had the army or the Revolutionary Guard on their side. And they were always subordinate to the supreme leader. So they might have been able to like adjust the women's headdress enforcement or something like that, but they weren't really able to reform. Secondly, the street demonstrators, they're not organized. There's no, you know, cells or command, line of command or anything like that. There are just people who are upset who go out into the street. I mean, it's very heroic. It's dangerous. Many of them killed or jailed. But they're not a revolutionary force. They're not able to overthrow. The MEK, which is a Islamist, Marxist-tinged group inside of Iran, they have some small amount of guns, and they have assassinated some people, blown up some people over the years. They are not, you know, for constitutional liberties. They are a totalitarian group, but they have a small military-ish presence. They're more valuable in terms of spying. They have people placed around in Iranian society, and they detect things like the onset of the enrichment of uranium. They were the ones that exposed this. There are American politicians that support the MEK. I do not support them. I think they would not be a good set of people to come to power in the society.
What about the son of the former king? Could he mount some kind of a campaign for himself?
Well,
he is right.
I think he in the United States, he's regarded as somewhat of an option, but I'm not sure the long history of the Shah in Iran with the Savak secret police and that sort of thing, that's going to be easily forgotten. And that the U.S., I mean, that's, I always have to laugh at when people say, well, Iran has killed the most U.S. people over time. But how many people has the U.S. killed there by supporting the Shah, exporting weapons to him, really basically propping him up for all those decades? And so we've killed Iranians, but, you know, this started in 1953 when we restored the Shah from a democratically elected leader. Now, he was a leftist, and he tried to nationalize the British oil company. But nonetheless, the U.S. and Britain were guilty of, you know, trying to overthrow the regime, which they did. And that led into the 1978-1979 revolution, because people were so fed up with the Shah and the brutality and that sort of thing. And so we have to remember that history. We only take the history back to 78. So there's a lot of bad blood between these two countries, and the Iranian people feel a lot of bad blood toward the U.S. So I'm not sure this guy is in the U.S. now. And, you know, he represents a restoration, again, of some sort of a monarchical system, although he's very careful not to go there in his thinking.
So let me say something about him. So he personally was too young to be involved in the Shah, his father's repression. Obviously, intellectuals in Iran who are, you know, important in crisis situation, they remember the Savak repression and the Shah's problems. The Reza Pahlavi himself has problems that he has an entourage around him who are ineffectual people. He's an indecisive person. He talks about constitutional monarchy and just being a kind of figurehead that can unite the opposition, but then he puts out proposals that would give the monarch quite a bit of power, more than what we would normally just say was a constitutional monarch. I think he's basically a much better person than the people who were there, and he's much better than a lot of the options. Now, there's another group called the Iranian Freedom Council.
Now, this group interests me.
So they are pretty good. They include monarchists. One of their main spokespeople is somebody who used to work for Reza Pahlavi. But they include democratic socialists, liberals, meaning classical liberals. It's a broad, you know, ethnic groups. So in Iran, only about 40% of the population are Persian. There's Azeris, there's Kurds, there's Baloch, there's Arabs. There's a lot of every kind of people there. And particularly the Kurds and the Baloch are, you know, potential military problem for the whatever government's there. So they have this united front. And again, they don't have any army on the ground. They don't have any organization that we know of in Iran. But of the exile groups, they are the most compatible with a free society.
Yeah, I think I don't necessarily disagree with that. And I don't necessarily think the Shah's son would be a bad leader, because he hasn't said anything that was, you know, too totalitarian. But I just don't. I think that the cloud over him is his father's, whether he has anything to do with it or not in that period of time. And also, how much internal support do these groups have? There's a lot of wishful thinking on the part of the West.
They are shouting Pahlavi's name at the demonstration. So he has some support.
Well, yeah.
I was in Iraq during the occupation authority. And so we had to deal with exiles as well as, you know, it was a regime change. So I have actually experienced a regime change. And exiles are really often more connected to the politicians of the country they're living in exile,
right,
than they are back mm-hmm. in the old country. And
like
that's
Chalabi
one reason
in Iraq.
A lot of people don't go into exile. It's a problem that there's, you know, it's been under a totalitarian repression, and then the natural leaders of a counter society have been severely repressed.
So what about another option? President Trump may be thinking to replicate Venezuela. Is there somebody who could be his Darcy Rodriguez in Iran?
I don't know. I mean, the Islamic ideology, the Islamist ideology goes much deeper, I think, than this into the regime than the socialist one does in Maduro's, what was Maduro's regime. So I think the real problem is how would you, if you put anybody in like that, they might get shot the first time. I mean, how are you going to keep them alive? That would be you'd have to keep them alive long enough to where they could consolidate some sort of power. So I'm fairly pessimistic about this. I mean, you never know what can happen. I'm hoping something else happens, but I kind of think that probably it may not. And I think Trump may have to deal with the fact that the Venezuelan model is not going to work. I think one of his positive aspects is he'll negotiate with anyone. Well, maybe that can be a negative as well, because I'm not sure Venezuela is going to be better off with this socialist versus that socialist. But, or, you know, if we found an Ayatollah that was more moderate, I'm not sure that Iran would be better off than it is now. But, you know, it would save face for Trump if he could negotiate some sort of Venezuelan, because I think he's in deep here, and he didn't really realize he was going to be. Because the Iranians are pretty adept at asymmetric warfare, and I'm not sure this regime is going to give up. They might even fight till the last person there.
So one of the problems is Trump himself has admitted that we have killed some of the people he hoped to negotiate with. So, you know, let's say you want to have a Quisling regime, so to speak. Quisling, Lutkin Quisling was the leader of Norway during German occupation during World War II. Anyway, let's say you want to have somebody like that. First of all, in terms of experience and being at the top levels, there's really not anybody. The most likely people seem to be very strongly pro the regime as it is. And, you know, maybe more. We think the guy that we killed, the supreme leader that we killed, was the most hard line that you could be, but that's not really true. People in Iran that criticize him from a more hardline viewpoint, and some of them are still left. So I agree with Ivan that it's the part of it is that the ideology is so strenuous and so deeply embedded both in the Revolutionary Guard and in just the run-of-the-mill government that exists there, that it's So the woman who's taken over in Venezuela does not have an attractive history either. She was in charge of a lot of repression. But the comparative levels of repression and numbers of people killed in Iran by this third tier people that might be turned to is much worse. They are really evil people. Now, you know, Trump could say, well, I don't care if they get their foreign policy straight. We'll just have to live with it. That might be where he ends up, but it certainly doesn't. It's not going to look good in the history books to say, "Yeah, we diminished their power, military power, temporarily, which they later then rebuilt, but we got a temporarily a much more hard line in terms of domestic repression group that didn't threaten anybody for a little while. Doesn't sound like a fabulous result.
No, well, it really
also,
doesn't.
When you have, I'll reiterate this point that Pape makes in his study of bombing people or attacking them in any way. When you have an external enemy, you tend to, and they assassinate your leader or get rid of the leader in some way, it tends to cause a power struggle on the inside. Meanwhile, you have the threat from the outside and the internal struggle. You're probably going to get somebody worse because they have to surmount all that, internal struggle as well as beating the external
enemy. They have to say to their rivals, "I'm the toughest person here to fight off our external enemy."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's a very powerful argument under these sorts of circumstances.
So it would be unlikely under that reasoning for example, the current president, Masoud Pezeshkian, who seems kind of moderate.
He belongs to that reform camp that I was mentioning earlier might get the headdresses. But by the way, during the time around the June bombing and subsequently, he, the president, and his other reform colleagues all, bowed down to the supreme leader and to Iran's foreign policy project. They in no way were pushing against that.
So Pezeshkian is not going to get together with the Iran Freedom Congress.
You just can't predict history. I will say that there is a group of reform politicians in Iran that are better than the hardline people, but they're not in power and they've never had a supreme leader. There's only been two anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think this demonstrates the perils of regime change and meddling in other countries.
It sure does.
Yes. I think we're going to see that play out, but I'm hoping not, but we'll see. I think.
Kind of one way of summarizing what we've been saying during this conversation is that, first off, the U.S. Constitution itself has been a bit of a casualty in the decision to trigger these hostilities. And it's troubling from an internal constitutional perspective to see the war power, declaration of war power of Congress be really made almost irrelevant and become a second or third tier thought as hostilities proceed. That's troubling. But then with regard to Iran itself, I was especially struck by what Ivan said a few minutes ago. First of all, that any attack, even one that might be in principle welcomed by dissidents in Iran, will trigger a rally around the flag effect. And I hear that there is a consternation in the country about the ways in which the U.S. and Israeli bombing have sometimes hit historic sites that have significance. And that, of course, will erode support even among dissidents. So rally around the flag there. And in the very longer term, Bill had said a few minutes ago that maybe this military action will retard progress by the Islamic regime on various kinds of weapon systems, including nuclear ones. But there could be a recoil effect. Having been bombed this way by the U.S. and Israel, there may be elements that rise to the top in Iran, which will be more determined than ever to build themselves up with nuclear weapons.
That's right. In other words, the people who feel the religious inhibition mm-hmm. against developing nuclear weapons under current circumstances
right.
would be easily swept aside.
The first Gulf War, they interviewed the media interviewed the chief of staff for the Indian military, and they said, "Well, what did you learn from Desert Storm?" And he goes, "Get nuclear weapons."
Oof. Yes, exactly. That's kind of the point, isn't it? So there's so many ways in which intervention by U.S. military force can tend to backfire. And we've seen it many times. So it's hard to be optimistic based upon that experience and the factors we have discussed. Final comments from either of you before we draw to a close?
I would like to bring up the bombing of the girls' school that happened on the first day. So in the coastal area, there was a girls' school. And I can say was because the United States destroyed it. We killed about 165 elementary school children and then also their teachers. So the current preliminaries from the U.S. military in terms of analyzing this, and by the way, the New York Times has done immense number of stories on this that are really quite high quality. But anyway, they say that the Defense Intelligence Agency gave the Central Command information about this site that was 10 years old. And so they bombed it. And it's in the vicinity of a naval facility, and, you know, they bombed it. And the building is clearly separate. CNN showed pictures from before the bombing. You could see inside, just publicly available, you could see kids playing in the school, kids going to school. It has playing fields outside of it. It's obviously a school. Now, one interesting thing that's still being discussed in the news media is, was AI involved? Because AI has been involved, artificial intelligence has been involved in past targeting in recent conflicts. So let's say you're going to bomb thousands of sites. So, well, one way to sort through all your information that you have is to use AI. Now, if you do that, you then should have a human review that's careful. But if you're going to bomb thousands of sites, maybe you don't have human review, or you don't have enough human review, or you don't have sharp enough human review. Some Democrats have been saying that Hegseth fired some portion of the people who would do this sort of human review, and they lay particular blame on him. I don't know that they're accurate in saying that.
So AI is not necessarily the omniscient solution that people think it is.
Well,
we're not
sure that it was even used in this case, but it has been certainly discussed as if it might well have been used.
Ivan, any final comment you want to toss in before we close?
Yeah, I think just to tie up the discussion, back to your lead-in, when we say we need to, if we have a little constitutional slippage, it would be good if it turned out well. I'm not sure what turning out well is, and that is almost never a very good a trade-off. I think the Constitution, that one of the big problems with warfare, and we saw this during the 20th century and into the 21st, was it erodes our republic when we do these things which are very dubious for our national security, but erode our republic at home through civil liberties reductions, going against constitutional process like Congress approving or declaring war, et cetera. So I think the Constitution should remain the most important thing, and foreign policy should take a back seat to that.
I am grateful to both Bill Evers and Ivan Eland for talking through some of these difficult issues, trying to sort out the constitutional issues, the likely turn of events in Iran, and most interestingly, various possible outcomes, including, as I said a few moments ago, the sense of recoil that even legitimate Iranian forces may feel as a result. And with that, we're just going to say goodbye to our friends who joined us, inviting them always to visit our website, independent.org, and join us again on Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody.